I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a look at the effect having a loved one incarcerated has on parents, children, other family members, and friends. This discussion will be a product of our partnership with Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Brittany Renfro with IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, Senior Director of Behavioral Health Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, a young ex-offender, and Angela Tomlin, Associate Professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about some fine reporting our friends at Side Effects Public Media have done on the effects of mass incarceration on families and especially the health of children. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, who is Senior Director of Behavioral Health Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, a young ex-offender, and joining us by phone is Angela Tomlin, who is an associate professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. I think probably to set this conversation up, the best way to do this is to listen to a piece that our own Jill Sheridan did about that sort of puts this problem in perspective. Indiana obviously is a place where this is a big problem. We have the second highest rate in the country. So we'll listen to Jill's piece first.
A social determinant of health, a condition or circumstance that plays into how a person is born, grows, lives, and ages.
I've noticed a change in my son, me not being there, because of being incarcerated.
Terrell Harris's son was young when Harris spent 2 years in prison on a drug charge. Now Harris is part of a research project that aims to identify how incarceration impacts family health.
I mean, it constantly puts them in a stressful situation because they're wishing their dad was here. Also, it takes away from that structure that they're normally used to on a normal day-to-day basis.
And it can be more than mental health problems. Some studies point to long-term physical health issues like heart problems and asthma, but the research is limited. This project aims to add data. Volunteers will go into communities to talk to people who have been impacted by the incarceration of a loved one and ask questions about how that has impacted the family's health. About 75 volunteers attended a summit last month held by the Indianapolis Congressional Action Network, or IndyCan, a nonprofit group helping to organize the research. More than 1 in 10 Indiana youth have a parent who has been incarcerated, the second highest rate in the nation.
But the hard part is, like, that plan.
IndyCan Executive Director Shoshana Spector led a session. She says incarceration should be a last resort, not a first response.
No child should be afraid that they'll never see their parents, even if it's just 6 weeks or 6 months, when there's plenty of alternatives.
Alternatives such as treatment and diversion strategies like crisis intervention. Spector says if communities don't commit to reducing the number of people being incarcerated, the cycle will just continue.
We are traumatizing people for generations.
The U.S. leads the world with incarceration rates, and Indiana has a 7% higher rate than the national average. Director of Riley Childhood Development Center, Angela Tomlin, says the social determinant of having a parent incarcerated can be a child's first strike.
So you think about it, everything is related all the way back to those early relationships and safe environments.
Tomlin is the research project psychologist.
Stress over time can build up, and what we've been finding through many different studies is that these effects of stress can persist into adulthood.
Black teens in Indiana are twice as likely to have a parent in jail as whites. Some evidence points to the relationship of mass incarceration and racial health inequity. This is the sort of data that the IndyCan project hopes to build on. Project volunteer Terrell Harris's wife served 10 years. She went to prison when her son was 2 and got out when he was 13.
So now imagine a son that you've never seen all these years and get out and trying to be a mother to that child. You know how much resentment that child has against you because you were gone?
Harris says that resentment and stress has led to health problems.
And now he's suffered from PTSD, ADHD, you know, because, you know, he's been in these messed up situations. And now he thinks that's the cool. Now because he has to live up to a status quo that his parents were incarcerated.
The group hopes to present their findings to the Indiana legislature next year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting and Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
That was some fine reporting from Jill Sheridan about the subject of today's show, the effects of mass incarceration on families, especially children. My guests are Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, Senior Director of Behavioral Health Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, who is a young ex-offender, and joining us by phone is Angela Tomlin, who is an associate professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Angela, I'm going to start with you. You know, one of the things that leaps out from Jill's story is the fact that this is a larger problem in Indiana than in most other places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we're second in the nation, that the rate of incarceration 7% above the national average. Why is that? What is it about Indiana that accounts for that discrepancy?
I think that it may be a couple of things. We are seeing more difficulty with opioid use in our state. And from my small experience working directly with people who are incarcerated, they often therefore drug offenses. So I think that may account for some of it. But it's also true that we have different laws than compared to some of our neighboring states, so that for similar offenses, people can get much higher sentences.
What do you have some examples?
I've seen examples that, for example, in Ohio, a similar charge could get 5 years or maybe a diversion program, like Shoshana Spector mentioned in the other clip, compared to much more than that, like as much as twice as much here.
Rachel, in terms of this, how many, you know, we say 1 in 10 Hoosiers, children, would have the experience of a parent being in prison. Could we put in how many kids are we talking about here then?
Sure. So what we know is that most of the individuals who are in our criminal justice system, about 65 to 70% of women and just over half of men involved in our criminal justice system have at least one child under the age of 18. Just in our Department of Corrections system right now, at last count, we had a total, and this was of September 2017, a total of 45,000 people involved in the Indiana state level Department of Corrections. And so that's not necessarily including county jails and other systems.
That's
like
a good sized city, actually.
Right, yeah. Right. So across the state right now, we're looking at 45,000 in the Department of Corrections. And that includes community corrections as well as people that are actually incarcerated in the prison. And so if you estimate that half of those have just one child, which is a very significantly conservative estimate, mm-hmm. we're talking at least 25,000, 30,000 children in our state affected by parental incarceration. And as you mentioned, we were found by a recent study from the Kids Count report to be second highest in the nation for children affected by parental incarceration, which is pretty astounding.
Brittany, you were one of those children at one point, right?
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about the circumstances? How old were you when was it your mother or your father?
My mother.
Your mother. When did she go?
I was like 20 years old when she had got arrested. You want me to tell the story?
Oh, sure. Please.
Okay. The story is we were at home and I guess one of my younger brother's friends had came over and I think he had did something, mm-hmm. but the officers came looking for him at her house,
mm-hmm.
and she let him in, you know, free willingly because she didn't have anything, you know, to worry about. And when she let him in, they were like aggressive with her and like trying to pinpoint stuff, like fault her for it. Mm-hmm. And I, like, she smoked cigarettes, but she had smoked a cigarette and the officer started getting aggressive and like, I don't know what the word will be, but like started getting angry at her for smoking a cigarette in her own home. Mm-hmm. So he told her to put it out and she put it out. And then I don't know exactly what happened after that, but he ended up tasing her in her chest and in the back of her neck. And they took her to jail, but she didn't have any, whatever happened, she didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay.
And when they took her to jail, there were like, I want to say 20 officers came and they were just like ransacking her house. They took some of her money she had put up, and like when like the other family members tried to, you know, get there and see what was happening, they didn't have a search warrant or nothing. So they like printed up something on their own and just like left it in there mm-hmm. on the floor. And she went to jail. She did like 2 months because they were trying to say that it was her fault why she got tased and stuff. But the officer said he felt like his life was in danger. And my mom is like so small. She's like 5'3", and the officer was like 6 foot.
So they were trying to argue then, it sounds like, that she was resisting arrest or
yes.
something, that was ultimately the charge. And while that is an interesting story, really what I want to talk about here is how it affected me. Yeah, it affected you. And I'm not to dismiss your mother's struggle or her story in any way, but we really want to focus here on what happens to those who are kind of left behind when a family member goes to jail. That's the experience you can speak to.
Okay. Well, see, my mom's my support system. Like, she's there when no one else is. So when she did get locked up, I was, like, really just, like, on my own to take care of my kid, because she helps me a lot with them. And just, like, trying to do stuff on my own without her, because, like, there was still her house bills and rent and all that stuff had to be paid also. And we were, like, we didn't really get any help that we needed. So we were just out there on our own.
That is not, Rachel, I presume, an uncommon experience.
So what was interesting about Brittany's story is at Volunteers of America, we for a long time have worked with families, mothers, fathers that are experiencing incarceration, and then as well as the children. And I think what was important about the story that Brittany shared at the beginning mm-hmm. was that many of the children we work with are present for the arrest and, mm-hmm. and incarceration of the parents. And despite, you know, what was happening behind the scenes, what we find is that with people that have been incarcerated one or multiple times, the majority of the time the children are present when that occur. And in terms of the effect on the child and then the subsequent separation and financial hardships and emotional hardships that transpire afterwards, it is the perfect breeding ground for some really significant, the development of some really significant issues for the child and the family.
Montez, now, you had the opposite end of that experience, right?
Yeah, I was the one incarcerated.
You were the one incarcerated. When did that happen?
If I've been in and out of, I'm 21 now, mm-hmm. but I've been in and out since I was 13. So I just got out January 24th of this year out of prison.
Okay. And how long were you in prison?
2.5 years.
What was the charge?
Armed robbery.
Armed robbery. What was that? You know, the experience here would be somewhat sort of reverse it with that it would be a parent, presumably, who would have been observing it at the first time. If you said you'd been in and out since you were 13, what was the impact on your parents?
It was hard on them because they had to keep calling. They had to call off work. Well, hard on my mama. Because my mama, she had to call off work to come to court days, and then she got to come and visit me and go through the whole process of trying to even get in there without getting turned around. So she had to go through that. Then just the money for putting money on the phone and different stuff like that from when I was younger. So, and it was a stress on her because she like, I want more for my child, but he's just out here and I don't know how to control him. So it was a lot of, it was stressful. It was really stressful on her. and my other, like my grandmother and stuff like that, because she also wanted me out doing different things and doing better. So they were stressing about stuff like that, so it brought a lot of stress on the family.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the effects of mass incarceration on families and especially the health of children. This is a product of our partnership with Side Effects Public Media. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, who is Senior Director of Behavioral Health Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, a young ex-offender, and Angela Tomlin, who is Associate Professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the effect of mass incarceration on families, especially the health of children. It's a product of our partnership with Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, who is Senior Director of Behavioral Health Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, who is an ex-offender, and joining us by phone is Angela Tomlin, who is Associate Professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. We have one more piece that Side Effects reported that I want to play because I think, you know, the first piece sort of showed us the scope of this problem, how many people are affected and what the effects might be. This piece by Emily Foreman drills down more to the human level. And that's where I think we want to take this conversation next. This is some fine reporting from Emily Foreman.
Janice McLean climbs on the bus at a stop downtown. She takes a seat among a dozen or so other women, all women, on their way to visit children, spouses, and fiancés in prison.
Hi.
Hi.
It's so nice to meet you.
Okay, we're going to pray. Father, we honor you.
Janice has been riding this bus for over 10 years to visit her 35-year-old son, Edward Hobson.
They call him Pearls. He don't really like to be called Edward.
She calls Pearl her knee baby, remembering him glued to her knee when he was just as tall. Pearl went to prison 16 years ago for murder. Janice struggled to stay in contact, and her health suffered.
I mean, I passed out the day of his trial. I mean, I just passed out on the floor and have been sick ever since then.
So the one health thing with the people in the prison is the importance of the touch and the hug.
Since 1998, Cecilia Whitfield has given thousands of families rides to prisons across Indiana. Cecilia and their driver, Linda, talk about the importance of touch a lot.
Linda has sent me a thing over the Facebook to talk about just 10 seconds hug helps the memory, helps to do healing.
It all started while visiting her son in prison. On those trips, she met many families needing rides. Several years later, she bought a bus on layaway and painted it purple and white. She named her prison ministry after her mom's favorite saying, use what you've got. Janice used to drive 6 hours round trip to see Pearl. The first time, the prison turned her away, and she cried for hours until they let her in. Pearl isn't the first child Janice lost. Her two oldest sons died. One got hit by a car. Another was shot. So when Pearl left, Janice's blood pressure skyrocketed, resulting in multiple trips to the ER.
And the depression just set in where basically I just didn't care. You know, I wasn't taking my medication like I was supposed to. I wasn't doing anything like I was supposed to.
Then Janice got really sick. First, a major blood vessel ruptured. 3 days later, she had a stroke. She lost her ability to speak, read, and write. Basically, every way of communicating with Pearl.
And the only highlight of my life, basically, was going to see him and knowing that I can't see. I couldn't handle it.
Her primary care physician wrote the prison. Janice's recovery depends on seeing her son. And it worked. The prison moved Pearl 20 minutes away, a more manageable distance for Janice to ride. And her speech gradually returned.
I need my ID.
Now she rides with Cecilia, who says Janice isn't alone. Among the families she's worked with, often stress and anxiety lead to bigger health issues. At the prison, Janice waits in her socks, holding a styrofoam bowl full of quarters for a vending machine lunch. Women ahead of her in line struggle to get through the metal detector. Is there underwire in your bra? A guard asks. 2 hours later, Janice returns to the bus with a photo. Pearl has his arm wrapped around Janice. Her beige shirt matches his beige uniform.
Any anxiety I may have had yesterday or last week or whatever, all of that is just gone.
Since her speech returned, they talk on the phone too. But seeing him helps her know he's okay.
I've seen my baby, you know.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
That was some fine reporting from Emily Foreman of Side Effects Public Media. We are talking today about the effects of mass incarceration on families. My guests are Rachel Halleck, who is Senior Director of Behavioral Services at Volunteers of America, Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Montez Williams, a young ex-offender, and Angela Tomlin, who is Associate Professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. I know part of what's going on here is that we're trying to study the effects here in Indiana of incarceration on not just the people who are incarcerated, but everyone whose lives are connected to them. Angela, I'm curious, have there been studies done elsewhere on this subject, and what have they shown us?
Well, the amount of research is not as much as we would like, but in some states they have better data than we have. Minnesota has a lot of good projects taking a look at how many children have a parent that's incarcerated. I think Rachel mentioned some good estimates for our state, but we'd like to increase those, improve our estimates. And what they're finding is that when children are apart from their parents due to incarceration, we can see a number of health challenges. We can see behavioral problems at times in school, and we can see issues that are affecting the whole family that Brittany did a great job describing in terms of finances and so on.
What when we talk about health problems, can we talk first about sort of the psychological manifestations, emotional things that we see?
Yes. Some children will show trauma symptoms. So, for example, separation from a parent or loss from a parent is considered a traumatic event. Seeing a parent arrested and treated in the way that was described can be a traumatic event. Mm-hmm. So we could see problems like sleep disruption, developmental problems, regression of development. We can also see irritability and challenging behavior that will play out and make it hard for kids to do well in school programs and in other group care.
Brittany, how many of those did you experience?
The things that I experienced from that, it was like, I don't know, the emotions like towards police officers from me seeing mm-hmm. that and stuff. It's like, I don't know, it's like I had this negative feeling towards them, seeing my mom and knowing that she went through all that kind of stuff.
And did you experience higher levels of stress? Any other manifestations that?
I think now, yeah, because I was talking with that with someone the other day, and they were saying I might need counseling for that because of it was suppressed in me, you know? So, like, I never really seen a counselor for stuff like that.
So, Rachel, if my math is correct, and I know we're doing this conservatively, we were saying only one child, more likely there are probably two or three kids per offender put through there, which means we could have six figures worth of kids, and that doesn't include parents, that doesn't include siblings, it doesn't extend. Are there services out there to provide support for these people and this traumatic time? And even if there are they adequate to the need?
Well, that's a big question.
It is.
So
there's a reason the show's called No Limits.
At Volunteers of America, for listeners that may not be familiar, working with families and individuals who are incarcerated has been one of our main areas of specialty. In 2009, we developed a program called Look Up and Hope that was funded through the Annie E. Casey Foundation and researched through Wilder Research for 5 years. And we used this program, we developed this program because what we found when we were working with women who were incarcerated was that the first thing that we heard when they came to us in one of our work release facilities was concern about where their children were located, if they were safe, who they were staying with, and what was happening with them. And so we developed this program called Look Up and Hope that is a program that uses what we call a family coach, who is essentially a case manager and a therapist and emotional support, a recovery coach, everything kind of wrapped into one. And this person goes and starts with the parent who is incarcerated, at the same time starts working with the family, the caretaker of the children, and the children. More often than not, usually only about 10 to 20% of parents who are incarcerated, only about 10 to 20% of them have a child in the foster care system. Usually those children are actually with one family member or rotating amongst family members. And so this program had really, really wonderful outcomes. And we have used that program as a model. Again, it was researched for 5 years. It was found to be a promising practice with families of color through the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And we have used this program to develop our Bridge to Success program that we have in operation right now, that uses that same model on a bigger scale. It goes into several of our prisons, starts working with the parents there, and then at the same time working with the family in a holistic manner, so that when that parent transitions out, that transition is as smooth as possible.
Montez, what sorts of things would have helped your family while you were incarcerated?
That would have helped them?
Yeah.
If they, psychologically?
Well, however. I mean, we're talking about having them make the adjustment here, so that, you know, at some level what I'm hearing out of this is obviously they're the immediate effects, but there's also the fact that this creates almost a cycle of despair, of violence, of trauma that continues on. So it seems to me the long-term goal here is to try to break that cycle.
Yeah.
And minimize the trauma if possible.
And I feel that the way that we could minimize the trauma is just really getting better programs to help out them, the families and the ex-offenders, because they some of them, they don't know what to do when they get put in a situation. Some of the families don't know how to go about it. And some of the inmates, they don't know how to go about it inside of there. So it's psychological parts that need to be worked on both parts. Because the family, they could have a program to where it could be able to help them with really why their loved one is behind there, just to help them keep in contact with them, keep them communicating. Because that's a big psychological thing with the inmates. They lose contact with their family due to the prices of these phone calls and stuff, because a lot of them are high. Mine was $8 for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like calling that. Some people you sit on the phone all day. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for them to even communicate to their family. But if they had somewhere it was like easier to make it where they know more, like that these facilities, that they even safe for it, where the person is even at, and that they even getting actual help. Because a lot of parents be worried, like, is my child even safe inside that environment where he at? Like, mm-hmm. he a good kid. Like, he should, like, we know he did something wrong, but at the same time, he in there with a whole bunch of people that y'all don't even want to be around. Y'all putting mm-hmm. a mirror in his place, and now they sitting here wondering, like, dang, like, and my kid gonna make, because they hear so many stories about what happens mm-hmm. in prison. I mean, some of it still goes on, a lot of it don't. Mm-hmm. But still, with you never being able to go in there, you would never know what's going on and what's not going on inside that prison unless someone was actually in there to tell you. And sometimes inmates call home and they don't even tell you what's really going on in there. And some of them, sometimes they actually do call and tell you. It's like, what can I do, though? What can I do to help my son if he's in there, he getting picked on in there, or he get about to get in a fight in there? How can I even do anything? I'm going to call up there.
So there's a feeling of helplessness.
Yeah,
on the part
hopeless,
of the
and helplessness and hopelessness.
For the family, and hopelessness, and there's a sense of loss. We are talking about the effects of mass incarceration on families, especially the health of children, but it's also about parents and siblings, anyone who cares about someone who
yes.
is behind bars. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Bob is done, and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hello, and thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, more of a commentary, I suppose. I am an ex-offender, and from the perspective of a demographic, I realize that people of color and the racial issues are certainly paramount, and I think drive a lot of this discussion. I am Caucasian and upper middle class, educated, mm-hmm. but my sons, because of my terrible choice, were horrifically affected. They're 18 and 15 now, and they're in the Franklin area. My 18-year-old is finally starting to get his life squared away, but the 18 months they were without me was just devastating to them, and just watching the process. And we had resources. We had family. We had really access to much of everything that they needed, but it's still there's no – it's the process of that separation. The crime is the crime. Mm-hmm. In my situation, there was the option for house arrest, which wasn't offered, and the victim of the crime requested that I be on house arrest for the sake of the boys. But irrespective of that, I don't know what the good answers are. I've heard Montez, and I think he's right, that trying to educate families and educate people going into prison to prepare them for what they're about to face, especially Montez starting at age 13, mm-hmm. it's ridiculous to think that he has the skills to cope and be successful, nor that his family would have the skills to cope on the outside and be successful. And we're going to have to figure something out. I didn't know the stats that I just learned from your show today, that we're number two in the nation. Mm-hmm. And 7% above the national norm, which that's more of a political concept, I'm sure. But I mean, just speaking from a personal perspective, my sons are they're just not doing well, and it is directly correlated to the separation. Even though, relatively speaking, it was short term, it was devastating.
Bob, before I let you go, I want to ask though, are there things? It's sort of a variation of the question that I asked Montez, also the one that I asked Brittany, which is, what would have, during that time, that 18 months, what would have helped your family?
I think, and this may be a little bit, I don't know if you know how possible it is or how what psychologists might say or counselors might say, a physical connection between, when you're talking children and parents, beyond, not in the confines of a visitation room, which is kind of a horrible experience, but physical connection with the children. The phone calls, Montez is right on. My family spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000, on phone calls in 18 months. But just, I think there's got to be some research done to how can we get the children of incarcerated moms and dads to be able to spend time physically with their missing parent. I believe that would be a good place to start.
Thanks very much for calling, Bob, and for sharing
your
story.
Thank you for your show.
Certainly. Angela, we're coming up on a break, but mm-hmm. can you say in about, 45 seconds, really what, because we've seen this over and over again, that sense of touch seems to be so important, to be able to make that physical connection with a loved one.
Yeah, I think that's especially important for very young children to be able to touch their parent. They may be confused if they have to see them through glass or through a window, and they may not understand what that's all about. There's also the issue that I think others have touched on about getting into the prison and the searches and so forth that are, you know, a different kind of touch that isn't feeling so nice to some young children. So that issue is important. In some circumstances, like at Indiana Women's Prison, they have the Family Preservation Program where they have a more child-friendly room to get around that visitation room where you might have to sit in really awkward ways and can't really touch your child. So it is an important issue and one that I don't think we have enough data on to really understand in this population. But in other populations, we know that touch is critical.
We are talking about the effects of mass incarceration on families, children, and other loved ones. My guests are Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, Senior Director of Behavioral Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, a an ex-offender, and joining us by phone is Angela Tomlin, who's an associate professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're following up on some fine reporting by our partners and friends at Side Effects Public Media. This is about the effects of mass incarceration on families and especially the health of children. My guests are Brittany Renfro of IndyCan, Rachel Halleck, who is senior director of Behavioral Health Services at Volunteers of America, Montez Williams, who is a young ex-offender, and joining us by phone is Angela Tomlin, who is an associate professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Linda has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Linda, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind? Linda, could I ask you to turn the radio down in the background because we're getting some feedback on it?
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Okay. I have a son that has been in and out of jail, not prison. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm his parent, one of his parents.
Mm-hmm.
73, mm-hmm. And his father's 76. The health effects on us, plus his four children, has been horrible. And he's been in and out, and I see the effects on his kids, on his sister, and on us, very negative effects.
Linda, and I'm going to ask you here to tell me, obviously, if I am pushing too hard, but I think it helps people actually to understand exactly what we're talking about here when you say negative effects. Are you comfortable telling us what some of those might be? I mean, about how it makes you feel, or...
Well, on myself, high blood pressure, nearly passing out when I go visit him, and we have taken his children to visit him, and they... I won't ever do that again because they get very upset. They don't understand, and a couple of them are teenagers, and... the two that are teenagers think it's kind of cool. I mean, you know, it's it's a very hard thing to explain, John.
I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that at all.
But it's, and it's been particularly hard on my son that has been in and out of jail, but not hard enough for him to quit doing what he's doing, evidently.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing your story and your experiences. I know that was not an easy thing for you to do. So I really do appreciate you calling in, Linda.
Well, and I'm an avid listener of public radio, and I think you're doing a very good service on giving people a chance to speak out and maybe giving them some pointers where they can get some help.
Well, let's hope that is the result of this program. Thank you very much for calling us.
Thank you.
Today.
Bye-bye.
Brittany, I saw your head nodding up and down, almost like a sewing machine while she was talking. It speaks to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, because I've been going through that, like with my daughter's father. He's actually, he just got sentenced, and they sent him to, like, Kentucky or something. And he was locked up for 4 years the first 4 years of my daughter's life, and she was going through so much in school. Like, she got suspended, I want to say 20 times in the school year, and they were saying she was just blurting out stuff and being mean and different stuff like that. And then he got out 4 years ago, actually, and then she got better. Like, she was getting good grades. I wasn't getting no calls. Mm-hmm. And he just got charged again for something that he didn't do. Like, there was DNA for someone else, but they charged him for it. And he got, like, 10 years for that. And it was no DNA on him or whatever. But, like, with the jail and all that, it is hard because, like, with them, when he was out, he was helping me. Mm-hmm. Like, from picking the kids up, food, if I was short on rent or anything, he was there to help. Mm-hmm. But now it's like it's all on me again to do it all again on my own. Mm-hmm. And then, like, my daughter doesn't understand that. And she's like, I don't want her to start acting how she was at first, but I just will have to, like, see if that does affect her that way, because she's been doing a lot better since he's been out, though.
Rachel, you've got some data, obviously, on the long-term effects of this, the stuff that lingers, you know, long, and we can tell. I mean, for Linda, for Brittany, I suspect for any number of people who have not called in here and have not had the chance to share their stories, this is part of their lives, and it's something that doesn't go away.
Yes, and I think one thing that's really important to highlight is that the factors that go into a person entering the criminal justice system are incredibly multifaceted. One of the common factors that we find study after study after study is the impact of childhood adversity or childhood trauma on individuals. And for anyone that may not be familiar with it, I would encourage listeners to look up the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente.
Yeah, it has one of the worst acronyms I've ever heard. They call them ACEs, and I can't see any way in the world that this is an ACE for,
exactly,
for a child.
Exactly. But, yes, but they are called ACEs.
Yeah.
It's essentially a questionnaire with 10 different questions in different categories, including abuse, neglect, parental separation through divorce or incarceration, and violence and addiction within the household. And I think Brittany put it very well earlier that somebody had said to her, and I'm paraphrasing you, so feel free to jump in and correct me, that someone had said, maybe you could benefit from counseling. And for you, that had not been even something that was on your radar.
Right.
And what the research shows is that for people that have been incarcerated, easily, study after study, 90% of them have experienced significant, pervasive, and repeated traumas and violence in their life. And a trauma is not a bad thing that happens. A trauma is something that completely shatters a person and changes their worldview. So we're not just talking about a bad day, mm-hmm. or a bad month. We're talking about really significant instances of violence and abuse.
It threatens their sense of being, really.
Exactly. And those are found to be predicting factors in development of addiction and development of mental health issues without any sort of intervention. And so the earlier that we can intervene in these families and with these individuals who are incarcerated, the better the outcomes. And that's something that I think is very, very important to remember as we're thinking about these children, is that we have to have these multifaceted and kind of wraparound services for the children that are affected by this, and also for the parents themselves. What we know is that we can't tell a person simply to stop a behavior, mm-hmm. without teaching them something different to do instead. And so if we could incarcerate this issue of addiction, it would go away. And so unless we have systems in place to be intentional in teaching replacement behaviors, both inside the institution and during real life application after a person gets out, that's where we're missing the mark most of the time in helping these families get back up on their feet and make the changes that they need to make.
We're talking about the effects of mass incarceration on families, especially children. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Sissy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Sissy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank Certainly. You. Thank you very much. Your guest and your speaker touched a bit on what it is I want to bring up. with my situation, what I experienced with my children who are now adults, and with my offense having been over 25 years ago, was the fear of abandonment, regardless of whether I was there, and especially when I got back. They're acting out then, and the issues that, okay, I promised the caller, the producer, that I wasn't going to cry, but my daughter is still in counseling now, because at the age of 24, because she's still so afraid that not only mom, but life is going to abandon her in her time of need. So even once I was back and I tried to assure she and her brother that I wasn't ever going to go away again, and especially when you're trying to raise your children in a Christian household, mm-hmm. and you teach them the difference between right and wrong, and then they experience a parent doing wrong, which brings up another issue. There goes that trust factor. Mm-hmm. So you're teaching me how to do good, but you didn't do good yourself, and now you left me, and the possibility exists that you may leave me again. And here I am now over 20 years out, and I'm still experiencing the ramifications.
Okay, a couple of things I'm going to say before I let you go, Sissy. One, while we appreciate the effort that you made not to cry on the air, you're always free to show your feelings around here. You're safe with with me. And the other thing is that I do hope that it gets better for you and your family, that all of you come to some sense of peace about this. Thank you very much for calling in and sharing your story with us. Take care. Angela, that's can't be an uncommon circumstance where, you know, we're talking about things we haven't even touched on yet. We talk about sort of the trauma, but what it does to the family unit here, too. What Sissy talked about, the breakdown of trust, the inability really to feel secure in the world in any way. What can we do about that? I mean, is there any way to deal with that?
Yeah, I think the caller was right to talk about therapy, and that's also very helpful for many people. But I think we have to think about broad-based kinds of interventions that can help at the community level. So one thing that I'm involved with my team with some Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funding is to take a look at whether or not preschool experiences that are high quality could benefit children in that age range when their parents are gone for prison. If you think about it, children need relationships, and when parents can't be available, what other positive relationships can we bring to bear? So preschool is one of the things that we're hoping to investigate more and to learn if it can provide some buffering, a routine, regular, reliable experience of relationship for young children that can't be with their parents.
Montez and Brittany, I mean, since you have experienced this from different points, I mean, did that feeling of lack of trust, of insecurity, hit you as well? Brittany, I can tell this is difficult for you, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, you're struggling with it a little bit. Montez, I mean, with your family, I mean, what effects did it have on the relationships within the family?
Well, since I was away, and I just like, a lot of stuff I started to learn on my own. I had to, even though I was locked up, I had to still learn. I had to survive in there. I had to grow in there. So what it had on me was I had to grow up by myself. So a lot of things I learned by myself a lot of times. Since I spent most of my time most of my childhood in there, and then that's really how to survive in there. And then just that's what I knew, like the rules of that. And then just how to carry myself, I had learned all that in there. And, like, they probably wish that somebody else was able to teach me or somebody was able to lead me, but I had to step up and lead myself. And then that what happens. I mean, that's what happened with some of the kids out here. They have to step up and eventually lead themselves with this world, and they don't know what they're getting themselves into. They don't know what's there because they got nobody to even show them.
Rachel, because Montez makes another point here that's valid, too, is that at some level, what happens in these situations when someone is as young as he is, talked about the impact Linda had, but in many ways what happens then is that the prison system becomes the parent.
Yep.
Exactly.
Rather than...
the parent becoming the parent.
Yeah, rather than the actual parent. And has anyone, Angela, Rachel, anyone done any research on the effect of that, of having the prison system, in effect, becoming a parenting device?
Well, what we know is that...
That's Rachel. I should tell the audience. That's Rachel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Yes. Is that children that are involved in the criminal justice system at an early age, between 13 and 16, are significantly more likely to develop long-term substance abuse and mental health issues. And essentially, as Montez put it very, very well, learning the skills that are necessary to survive while you're incarcerated are very different than the skills that are necessary to survive on the outside. Yes.
Mm. Angela, do you have anything to add?
Oh, I think Rachel said it very well. And I also just wanted to go back to Brittany's comment about how difficult it is for the parent that is left behind and the need for support for that parent. Their life has changed as well. And then it's difficult for them to do what the children need.
So we're getting close to the end of the program here, and we've gotten kind of a flurry, I see, from the call, a couple of Facebook messages, really dealing with systemic problems here, that part of it is that we just, in this country, have way too many people behind bars, that most police states don't have numbers like this. I mean, in terms of dealing with this, is some of it... some of the solution, I know this is a big question to throw very, very much at the end, that we need an overhaul of our law enforcement system. Rachel, I'm going to throw that to you with the understanding that you've got about 60 seconds to solve a major problem here.
Well, I think that there are currently some movements toward reform. And these practices are very, very promising. There are things like drug diversion programs where people can participate in treatment rather than being incarcerated. And if they are able to successfully complete treatment, they're able to stay in the community with their families while getting the help and the support and the accountability that they need. I think there are programs now in place starting to come about to help support the people as they are transitioning out of prison. I think where we really need a lot more focus is on that prevention piece, as well as making sure that there's a strong continuity of care for individuals and their families as the primary parent is transitioning out, but also that we don't forget these children that we often refer to as the orphans of justice while the parent is incarcerated, and being intentional about creating supports not only for the person that is incarcerated, but for all of these individuals that are affected by the incarceration as well.
That'll probably have to be the last word for this hour. Our format doesn't often frustrate me, but with this conversation, I feel like we probably should do another 2 or 3 hours, and I can promise both you and our listeners it's not going to be the last time we talk about this. I'd like to thank my guests, Brittany Renfro, Rachel Halleck, Montez Williams, and Angela Tomlin, for what has been an enlightening hour of conversation. Also would like to thank our listeners for sharing their stories and for tuning in today. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.